the smoke management rule implementation, which will include Doug Graff and Michael Orman as the main presenters. If we have them teed up and ready to go.
Okay, good morning all. Chair George, Chair Imason, members of the EQC, members of the Board of Forestry, Director Whitman and State Forest Authority. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief of Fire Protection for the Department of Forestry. It's always an honor for me to announce this topic because I truly believe this exemplifies what interagency partnerships should look like in our effort and collaboration towards managing the smoke management program. As previously stated, today we'll offer an update and status of the program's efforts. Next slide, please. Following me, we have a group from Department of Forestry, Oregon Health, and Department of Environmental Quality to speak on the details of the smoke management program. And before I hand it off to my colleague, Michael Orman from DEQ to set the stage for the presentation, I do have one announcement to share to the group. I'd like to highlight and thank Nick Yonker for his service to the state. Nick is the program manager and has administered the smoke management program for the past 31 years of service with the Department of Forestry. And he has now reached that time where he's taken on new endeavors in his retirement this April 2021. And for context, to add some context to his service, the smoke management program was established in 1972. And Nick started with the department in 1990, where he served as a meteorologist and then transitioned into the manager of the program for the past 11 years. So in context of the 51 years of the program's service to the state of Oregon, Nick Yonka has been a part of this for 31 years, providing the leadership and steady hand to get us to where we're at today. So congratulations, Nick. You had your first program review of the smoke management in 1991. And you had many more following that. The latest, of course, was which this group, the EQC and the Board of Forestry, passed new and foundational rules in 2019 March. You also, Nick, saw the beginnings of contract service meteorological work provided by the department for the Willamette Valley Open Burn Program administered from DEQ, and then providing meteorological services to the Agriculture Department for agricultural burning since 2010. So a lot of changes has come away and the way through the program. And Nick has been there from the beginning in 1990. And he will enjoy some downtime with his family, his wife and kids, three kids who are now up and out of the home. But congratulations and thank you so much for your service, Nick, and you will hear from Nick shortly. Now, with that, I'll turn it to Michael Orman to set the stage for the remainder of the presentation.
Doug, Chair George, Chair Imason, members of the Board of Forestry and Environmental Quality Commissioners. For the record, my name is Michael Orman. I'm the Air Quality Planning Section Manager for Oregon DEQ. I just want to start by also echoing Doug's comments for Nick. You know, we at the DEQ and ODF will be have a strong foundation to work from on smoke management because of the work that you've provided for the state, and we really appreciate your service and thank you for setting us up for a strong future on smoke management and the collaboration between DEQ and ODF. And the work that we'll be talking about today is, as Doug mentioned, a review of the implementation of a lot of the collaboration that we've talked about up to this point. We'll be talking about since the launch of the program in 2019, how the improvements to the program in 2019, how The two agencies have worked together to implement the rules, and the collaborations led up to this point. We'll cover a little bit of the COVID complications and how that collaboration between the agencies had helped us navigate that new space, and continue to find the balance that the program is designed to find in prescribed fire smoke and protecting public health. And with that, I'll go ahead and pass the mic on to the next presenter, which I believe should be Nick Yonker.
Thank you, Michael and Doug, for that warm send-off. I want to thank the board members and commissioners. For the record, I am Nick Yonker, Smoke Management Program Manager for the Department of Forestry. I will be covering the overview of the changes to our smoke management plan, the implementation so far, and answering one of the questions that was asked by the EQC back in 2009 when we had the plan approval. So starting off with the goals of the 2019 smoke management plan update, first bullet, create more opportunity for the use of prescribed fire. Essentially, it's increased use of prescribed fire burning can mitigate negative effects of wildfire, especially ecological damage as well as property damage. The second bullet, preserve public health and health protection and including vulnerable populations. Essentially, controlled burning is controlled. It is done when we deem the best possible conditions meteorologically, fuels wise, and timing during the day. And so that helps mitigate or reduce the amount of time that smoke stays in an area and the amount of smoke versus what wildfire does, where we have really no control. And finally, encourage timely and comprehensive communications. Essentially, this is the first time in our program history, in our review, that we've added to our rules a comprehensive part of our rule being communications. And that includes a statewide communication framework and community response plans. And I'll talk more about that on the next slide. So go ahead and move to the next slide. So these were the three key changes to the smoke management rules that were focused on in the 2017-2018 review. First of all, the intrusion threshold moved from being a no tolerance or basically no smoke into smoke sensor receptor areas to changing that to minimize emissions in accordance with the EPA National Ambient Air Quality Standards. So the Ambient Air Quality Standards, you probably well know, is 35 micrograms per cubic meter of PM2.5 over a 24-hour period. Our intrusion threshold was to stay a little bit lower than that, 75% of the exceedance threshold that would make for an intrusion. And then we also added a 1 hour average of 70 micrograms per cubic meter, because we don't breathe on a 24-hour basis. We breathe on a minute by minute, hour by hour basis. So we felt like we needed to have something for the short term. However, that 70 microgram 1 hour average can be exempted by rule if a SSRA does produce a community response plan that is approved by the Department of Forestry and DEQ with advisement from Oregon Health Authority. Secondly, as I mentioned before, developing that statewide communication framework, which is mainly for managers of forestry managers. It includes five elements, and that is a purpose and the purpose and importance of prescribed burning, the health risks of smoke from both wildfire and prescribed fire, how to reduce exposure from smoke, finding out about nearby planned units, and finally, up-to-date current information on smoke impacts. So that framework can not only be used by managers of the programs, but also we can send this information out to the public as well, statewide. In addition, developing community response plans puts that communication framework in a much more personal, local level to our smoke vulnerable SSRAs or smoke sensitive receptor areas. The idea being is that these communication framework is part of those community response plans, but the idea is that the community will coordinate throughout all their leaders in the community and those people who are vulnerable to smoke and develop a plan for how to notify and mitigate smoke for the vulnerable residents of that community and do that throughout the burning season. And then finally, the last key change was to burn more efficiently by removing size and thickness restrictions of polyethylene or PE burn pile coverings. So it's obviously shown that when we burn dry fuel, that that's much more efficient and produces less emissions. And so if you have something covering that fuel, especially during the fall and going in toward the winter as we get wetter and wetter, that the greater the size up to a certain point, at least to cover a good portion of that pile, at least 60%, as well as greater thickness to prevent ripping and tearing with the storms that come in and produce the wind and can rip up that PE. So having that increased size and thickness helps keep the pile drier longer. And when it is burned, it will be burned more efficiently with less smoke emissions. Next slide, please. So I want to touch on some statistics that have occurred since 2019, since the implementation of our plan, which started March 1st, 2019. The first year, we had over 200,000 acres of prescribed burning take place, which was 14% higher than the average of about 176,000. And that year we had 38 smoke incidents, which is lower than an intrusion. In other words, underneath that 26 micrograms or 70 micrograms on a 1 hour basis, and 6 intrusions. So we consider that a success because what we're trying to do is increase the amount of burning, but maintain or keep down the number of intrusions. So we feel like by having smoke incidences, very light amounts of smoke in communities, that we have not reached that threshold, which we only reached 6 times, and we had just light amount of smoke there. So we were managing and staying within the spirit of the EPA rule. And finally, the 10-year average at that time was 9. Now, 2020 presented obviously a new challenge with the COVID pandemic, and that changed things and reduced the amount of acres burned to less than 130,000 acres, of which during the springtime, we instituted throughout all the burning community, a voluntary restriction or restraint on burning because of COVID, since that is affected by smoke and smoke inhalation from those people who have it and those who could get it. So, and at that point, there was a voluntary restraint, and our federal partners decided to completely eliminate burning during the springtime. So they're the main burners during the springtime. And so essentially 90% of the burning would stop right away. And even prescribed private land burners were not doing very much as well. So that was the springtime. As we moved toward the fall, we recognized that we were going to have to do burning. And we developed a plan with DEQ and Oregon Health Authority to develop a plan with the continuing statistics that from the governor's office on watch lists and phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, and so forth. And so we modeled how the counties were doing, how much we could burn. And so if it was a county that was under more restrictions, we used our legacy rules prior to 2019. And if they were improved, then we would allow doing our normal rules. Well, things obviously got worse as we got toward November and December, and the governor's office changed to a risk-based system. And so we decided to just go immediately back to our legacy system of smoke intrusions and so forth. So we used rules prior to the 2019 update. That year, we basically had only one smoke incident and zero smoke intrusions, which was a record for the since the inception of the program. And so that was, in that respect, it was very good considering the COVID concern. Also in the fall, burning was reduced, not just from COVID, but obviously the epic wildfire season actually burned a lot of the area where we would have prescribed burn. So that was taken out by wildfire, as well as then we also had a fairly dry fall, and we really didn't get going on a lot of pile burning until later in November and into December. Next slide, please. Finally, the last slide that I'll be briefing had to do with a question that came out of the EQC from the 2019 update, January 2019 period. And that was, what are the ecological benefits to prescribed fire during the wet season? So we looked into that, and we found a 2009 literature review from dealing with Western mixed conifer. And it showed that essentially that fire intensity and seasonal growth of vegetation, whether trees or plants underground or vegetation under the trees, are the two key factors dealing with how the ecology handles the situation and actually what damage can occur. So essentially, fire intensity obviously creates the greatest amount of damage. But when you combine that with seasonal growth, if you have an intense fire that occurred, whether wildfire or prescribed fire, during the seasonal growth period, which is usually in the forest and the mountains, is the later spring period, then that creates the most ecological damage to the vegetation, trees, or plants. As you go into the summer and the growth stops and the tree goes back into dormancy, you still are dealing with intense wildfire, but if it's at a, kind of 6-1, half dozen of the other situation where basically it's the same thing, intensity is the same in the late spring versus the summertime. If it's the same, you'd actually have more damage because of the seasonal growth as well as the fire intensity. Fortunately, for prescribed burning, which is what we're handling or dealing with, is that prescribed burning is usually done in the wetter part of the season, starting with in the spring, in the early to mid-spring, so a little bit earlier than actually the seasonal growth starts, and then later in the more dormant period of the mid to late fall into winter period. So we're actually burning during the most ideal time to create an ecological benefit for the forest during those times where we have neither seasonal growth nor the likelihood of great fire intensity.
Nick, if you can hear me, this is Tom Imason. It looks like Vice Chair Barrasso has his hand up, may have a question for you.
Thank you, Chair Imason. Imason, Commissioner Barrasso.
Thank you, Chair Imason. Nick, in some ways I should have paused the end of the slide, but it actually relates to the slide back. And I just wanted to make sure if I don't know if you're able to, person controlling flood. On this slide, just as we're comparing, it was ringing to me as we were comparing the smoke intrusions in 2019, 2020 with the 10-year averages. I just want to check. I know that we had different smoke intrusion thresholds. Like we established a higher threshold starting in 2019. So can we actually, is six smoke intrusions in 2019 comparable to what would have been a smoke intrusion in a 10-year average? Like, was that based on looking at the same type? Did we actually take that data and say, in the past 10 years, these would have been smoke intrusions based on 2019 year levels, or so can they actually be comparable? That was just what was ringing to me, because I appreciate everything that's been done here, but I wanted to make sure I understood the data that was being shown.
That's a very good point. And in this, we did not, to be perfectly transparent on this, is that we were considering, now it's, you have a new definition of intrusion. So we stuck with that definition of intrusion to go back and determine from prior to that. I'd have to go back and research that, but I want to mention that the smoke incidents that you see, that 38 number, not only includes actual SSRAs, which we are basically where we focus on in the intrusions, but it also includes other communities as well. So that 38 number is not just SSRAs. It includes other places that that we are monitoring, but not that are not an SSRA. So I would say probably potentially half of those are probably other communities besides SSRAs. I can't say exactly for sure. I'd have to look that up. But yes, there would be essentially any smoke that got into an SSRA would be considered an intrusion. And so that number would have gone up if we had included that, you know, that statistic that it was any smoke that got into an SSRA would have definitely increased the number of smoke intrusions had we been using the legacy rules. However, that changes because we are trying to do something different. And if we'd stayed with the legacy rules, we would have considered that. And probably there would have been less intrusions because we would be working under old rules, trying to keep smoke out completely. So that's why, you know, to be perfectly transparent, there is a difference there, and I don't show that on the slide.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I just want to make sure I understood. Thank you. Again, and really, really appreciate all the great work.
That concludes my portion of the briefing. Margaret Miller from DEQ will be presenting next.
Thank you, Nick. And thank you, board and commissioners. My name is Margaret Miller, and I'm the air quality planner and forester working on smoke management for DEQ. And like Nick said, I'm gonna take over. I'm gonna start by talking about emissions reduction techniques. And as you heard, the 2019 rule change removed the size restriction on polyethylene sheeting used to cover slash piles. This decision was based on established science that burning wet piles of wood debris emitted more emissions of toxic air contaminants than burning dry piles with or without polyethylene. Oregon is a rainy state, and it is important to keep slash piles dry to have the best combustion efficiency as possible. Following the changes, the EQC asked for some additional information on the usage and coverage amounts, specifically wanting to know if removing the size restriction was going to drastically increase the average size of covers used. ODF does collect some information on the usage of PE covers, but not specific enough data to tell us the average size of covers used. So the information we needed, we had to collect in a different way. So an informal PE usage survey was conducted by the Oregon Forest Industries Council. And that was to collect the usage and slash cover sizes. This informal survey was distributed out to industrial landowners, and we had approximately 15 unique responders. And the responses showed that about 80% of them used slash covers and that the average size of PE used was 11 by 12. Historically, we allowed 10 by 10. ODF and DEQ would like to have more data on this topic. ODF is working with their IT group to add information in both the burn registration and accomplishments reporting on PE slash covers. Additionally, DEQ is interested in the possibility of conducting a life cycle analysis on alternative disposals of slash coverings. As you are aware, there is emissions concerns related to our alternative disposal methods because of the fuel needed to get the covers from where they are being used to where they are being disposed. Obviously, having additional data across the state and more research on the impacts of alternative disposals will be informative and help us make future decisions. Next slide. Obviously, another way to reduce emissions is to burn less piles and to promote the use of non-burn alternatives, including biomass utilization. Actually, the Governor's Council on Wildfire Response, which was tasked to review Oregon's current model for wildfire prevention, preparedness, and response, and then analyze whether or not it was sustainable and provide recommendations, did make a recommendation. The mitigation committee outcomes included a request that state agencies work collaboratively to investigate alternatives to prescribed burning. Specifically, the request was to look closely at the potential for biofuels and biomass industries in Oregon. DEQ is a supporter of non-burn alternatives and is in the process of developing a project plan related to biomass utilization. This project is still in the planning phase, but the goal is to host a series of biomass working group meetings, which could include representation from other state and regulatory agencies, industry champions, and biomass stakeholders to better understand this as an alternative in our state. Next slide. So as you also heard from Nick, another key change to our smoke management plan was to encourage timely and comprehensive communication. This means not only communication between our core agencies, but also across stakeholders and the public. There are several ways we are ensuring timely and comprehensive communication. One way is that DEQ, ODF, and OHA have assigned memorandum of understanding, which clearly states our roles and responsibilities and requires that we meet a minimum of twice a year to talk about implementation. I can assure you that we meet a lot more than twice a year, but that's what the memorandum says. Another way that we ensure timely communication is by requiring an after-action review for any smoke impacts that exceed the NAAQS, or the National Ambient Air quality levels. An ARA or an AAR, an after action review, is a structured review or debriefing that analyzes what happened, why it happened, and how it can be done better by the participants and those responsible for the burn. We did complete two after action reviews in 2019, including one for Chiloquin, which I put as an example in my slide. And we didn't actually have any NAAQS exceedances or intrusions in 2020, so we haven't completed one last year, but this is a great way for us to understand what happened and how we can learn from what happened to make better decisions next go around. Next slide. Another important type of communication that we're trying to promote is the establishment of community response plans. The goal of these community response plans are to promote communication between the entities that conduct prescribed fire and the local public health authorities and the public, especially those community members that are most vulnerable to smoke. In the 2019 legislative session, DEQ received $250,000 in general funding to assist Oregon communities with the development of community response plans and to evaluate the implementation and strategies that to mitigate impacts from increased prescribed fire smoke on vulnerable populations. DEQ awarded five communities with funding to develop and expand their community response plans and implement these smoke mitigation strategies. Scope of work included, but was not limited to, inventorying existing and needed response protocols, establishing and regularly convening a community response plan task force, hosting community response planning input sessions with the community, and developing and obtaining support for community response plan that was consistent with our Oregon rule. And finally, the implementation of various smoke mitigation strategies. These projects have been really successful, but that was not without challenges. Obviously, when these projects started in early 2020, we had no idea that we would be doing this work in a pandemic. So communities, some communities struggled more than others, and some local public health authorities had more capacity than others. But for the most part, communities have been able to pivot and adjust to sort of this virtual life that we now live in. Next slide. Oregon now has two active community response plans, and we've approved 2 one-hour exemption requests. That was actually as of last month when Ashland's community response plan was submitted for a one-hour exemption request. And as you all are aware, Ben has an approved community response plan and has actively been working with it and has a one-hour exemption that was approved in March of 2019.
Margaret?
Yes?
I understand that Chair George has her hand up for a question.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Emerson. Hi, Margaret. My question had to do with a few slides back. We probably don't necessarily need to go back in the slide deck, but you were talking about alternatives to prescribed burning, which you folks think might be something to explore further. I was just wondering about what is the extent of the use of those approaches in Oregon at this time? And is there some consideration of, you know, some sort of use of incentives to promote expanded use of those approaches?
Very good question. And actually, that's what the goal of the project, which again is in its planning phases, but hopefully will be launched in 2021, is to better understand that those questions that you have. And so ultimately, we want to understand not only regulatory authority, process complexities, operational limitations and barriers, but those things that we could do to incentivize and simplify maybe some of those things that are complicating it. And we also want to understand maybe associated environmental impacts that might be a concern.
I look forward.
But yes, we do want to identify opportunities.
Sounds great. We look forward to hearing the results of that work.
Yeah, we will keep you updated for sure. So as I was mentioning, we have our two community response plans now. And I really want to highlight the importance of this work. As you know, smoke is smoke. And many of these communities and communities across Oregon are dealing with smoke for various reasons and across many seasons. So that includes wildfire smoke, winter wood stove smoke. But the communications and smoke mitigation strategies that have been developed in our community response plans work for any smoke situation. And we're excited that these projects can serve dual purposes, especially for wildfire smoke, which, as we know, can be really bad. We're encouraging, and I've heard that many of the communities developing community response plans plan to update their community wildfire preparedness plans to have their community response plans or their smoke response plans as an official appendix to these plans, which we think is really important. I also think that I'd like to highlight Ashland's smoke mitigation strategy, which as you can see in these pictures, was an amazing project. They actually distributed out 400 HEPA air purifiers in the summer before the September wildfire smoke event. And they're going to be doing an additional 200 HEPA filters before the spring of 2021 ends. These were distributed before the smoke event. And so Ashland was also able to utilize their communication strategies to tell residents that smoke was coming from these wildfires and that they needed to create an indoor clean air space by closing all of their doors and windows and turning on these HEPA filters that they had received in their distribution project. This was an amazing project, and obviously we didn't realize that when we funded it that there was going to be record-breaking smoke event that year, but we're thrilled that the residents of Ashland were protected and that Ashland was doing their job to build a smoke-resilient community. And that's really what we want to do with the community response plans, is we want to build more smoke-resilient communities. So I am going to be concluding my slides. I want to make sure there isn't any additional questions for me before I pass this presentation over to Gabriella Goldfarb from Oregon Health Authority.
There was a question there.
Well, Chair Emerson, Chair George, I just wanted to also note the time for the commission. I think we're a little over, and Just wanted to flag that and see if you'd like us to continue on the presentation or continue what your decision might be there.
I have one quick question. This is Tom Iveson. You know, we heard from Bend and Ashland, while we at the Board of Forestry, and I'm sure for EQC as well, we're developing the new operational plans here. I'm just curious about the extent to which you've mentioned four other communities are working on community response plans. Is there, I would assume there's an appetite beyond those, and I'm just curious about the resources available for additional work on community response plans.
Yes, there is a need not only for additional community response plans for other smoke sensitive receptor areas and areas prone to smoke, but also for the implementation of some of the mitigation strategies that have been identified in the plans. And so we think it's incredibly important, and we are hoping that we can get additional funding to be able to continue to do work like this. And so any support that we can get from board members and commissioners that back that, we'd be happy for that support.
Great, thank you.
Chair Iveson, Chair George, to add a little more detail there as well, the 2019 legislature awarded DEQ funds for the project that Margaret described and for also work on smoke management community response plans. And so the legislature is in session now, and there's been some discussion about the same question that you asked, Chair Iveson, on the need and other communities that might benefit from that work.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll pass it over to Gabriella.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair George, Chair Iveson, and members of the board and of the commission. I am Gabriella Goldfarb. I'm the Environmental Public Health Section Manager at the Oregon Health Authority. So I will try to speed things up a little bit. Some of what I'm going to say, Director Whitman mentioned in his opening, and this slide is, you know, reminding us all of the big picture, why the state is pursuing expanded prescribed burning and why OHA came to the table to support that work. And of course, this is just showing us what we all experienced in September, which was many days of extraordinarily high smoke across the state. As you've heard from OHA throughout the rules update process, and Margaret, music to our ears, Margaret saying smoke is smoke, regardless of whether it's from wildfire or prescribed burning. With wildfire, there's the potential for more of the population to be impacted more severely. Next slide, please. So this is just one slice of the evidence of how the September 2020 wildfires impacted our healthcare system and people, thanks to near real-time syndromic surveillance reporting about people coming into emergency departments and urgent care centers who were complaining of asthma-like symptoms. So you'll see a steep increase in those asthma-related visits, that's the orangish-brown line, beginning September 6th, when statewide 24-hour average fine particulate matter, PM2.5, levels began to rise sharply. And increases in these visits mirrored the increased PM2.5 levels for the following 2 weeks until September 20th, and then remained higher than expected into early October, nearly 2 weeks after statewide PM2.5 levels had returned to normal levels. During the worst overall air quality, which stretched from, let's say, September 6th to October 3rd, compared to the previous month when air quality was less affected by wildfire smoke, we saw emergency department visits for those asthma-like symptoms increase by 25% statewide. It's important to note, however, that Hispanic populations in Oregon experienced a 30% increase in daily visits for asthma-like symptoms compared to 22% for non-Hispanic populations. So with time, we expect to have a fuller picture of the impacts and costs attributable to past wildfires as we get the lagging data on hospitalizations, mortality, injuries, occupational claims, other health-related costs, and to get a sense of how that breaks down by race, ethnicity, and age. Next slide, please. So bringing us back to prescribed burning, OHA sees the planning, outreach, and communications that you heard about from Margaret and especially to vulnerable populations as key to making sure we can avoid or reduce health impacts from prescribed burning smoke. And we have seen those really strong plans out of Bend and Ashland, promising work from the other communities that DEQ has funded. And most of those communities have had to contend with limited or minimal engagement from local public health authorities who were, you know, understandably consumed by pandemic work. But, you know, even under the best of circumstances, local and tribal public health has not been resourced historically to do this kind of work, even though having them at the table is really important for identifying and engaging those smoke-sensitive populations. As an aside, you know, the public health system's path to having that capacity is through public health modernization. The governor's requested budget for modernization, which has been an ongoing process for the public health system that is under consideration by the legislature this year, would for the first time allocate funds to county and public tribal health and community organizations for just this type of environmental health work. So we do have a challenging budget picture, of course, and so the outcome is uncertain, but we're hopeful that we will grow that capacity and have the public health system engage more fully over time. Next slide, please. I'll briefly recap the very unexpected area of collaboration from compared to the last time we presented to you as a group. And by this time last year, OHA had already stood up a coronavirus incident management team. We had our first diagnosed case in the state a year ago, February 28th, but the full enormity of what was happening really hit in mid-March. And so that really kicked off the ongoing coordination among OHA and ODF, DEQ, but also ODA and the state fire marshal when we issued a joint press release in April, urging people to avoid as much burning as possible, including prescribed burning, given what we thought of then is primarily a respiratory disease. And as Nick talked about, we did indeed see very reduced prescribed burning in the spring. So we worked together over the summer on guidance for fall burning season and put that through the state incident management team for COVID to basically fall back to legacy rules in those different counties. At one point, it was based on phases, and then we had to retool in mid-October when the state changed the framework to risk levels. And throughout, we worked in great partnership and very nimbly to navigate what was a very challenging situation. Let's see, I think you can move to the last slide. So I'll wrap up the joint presentation here, bringing up the rear with appreciation for all the good partnership among our three agencies implementing the updated rules, and with more of the same ahead, I'm confident. I did want to take a moment to let you know there's one new name on there, Kim Pham, who's sitting in on this session. Also, you see listed as a contact, and she joined the OHA team a year ago as our emerging environmental threats lead, immediately was on COVID for 6 months, but was able to get her back after the fires to help us with this work. And she'll be supporting our collaboration among our agencies. So we would, of course, be happy to answer any questions from the commissioners and board members, from all of you as time allows. And thanks for your time and attention.
Great, thank you. I don't see, Board Member Kelly.
Yeah, I have a quick question. I hesitate to even bring this up in this current moment, but I'm interested in low-cost, low-tech solutions. And given that we've all learned a lot about masks and there's more willingness to wear masks, is there any effort in planning around promoting the wearing of the appropriate kind of masks in both wildfire and in communities that would be affected by prescribed burns?
So I think we're going to be seeing a lot of, commissioners, our Chair George, Chair Amison, and Commissioner Kelly, Board Member Kelly, I'm sorry. I think we're going to be seeing a lot of research coming out about masks and face coverings. Typically, the research has shown that the kind of cloth face coverings that people wear that are protective against COVID are not protective against PM 2.5. And so and for people who are most vulnerable to smoke, wearing a respirator, I mean, many of you probably, a number of you probably have worn respirators professionally and know that there's, you know, it's actually, that's not good for your health if you're wearing it too long either. And so somebody who is has a health compromised health status, a respirator, kind of N95 mask is not really going to be a good option. The picture that Margaret painted of people being able to have clean air spaces in their houses using air filtration devices, that's really where we need to go to be able to protect people, both in the wildfire smoke context and in the prescribed burning smoke context, and the good communication through this community response planning is really key in the prescribed burning, actually in both of those contexts. I totally agree with what Margaret was saying. We are thrilled that these community response plans are going to do double duty to have those communication mechanisms in place to let people know when they're at risk of smoke and what steps they can do to protect their health.
Well, and we have another hand raised from a commissioner.
Yes, this is Molly Kyle from the EQC. I really appreciated hearing the update on the smoke management plan. Last year was such an unusual year, right? My question actually kind of goes back to 2019 when this was starting to get up and running, and in particular, the need to establish those communication plans with communities who would want to do more intensive burns like Bend and Ashland and Fuse and some like that. But I also recall that was part of kind of the unfunded mandate aspect of this agreement. So I am curious in, you know, kind of reflecting back to when this 2019, when this was first starting, how the process of establishing those communication plans went, community feedback, and trying to get a better understanding of how easy it was or the barriers that you encountered with establishing communication plans into the most vulnerable people within the communities that did want to do more intensive burning. Because I remember that being part of kind of one of the unanswered questions at the time we were making these decisions.
So, Chair George, Chair Imeson, and Commissioner Kyle, I'm going to turn it over to Margaret because she's the one who's been really working so closely and supporting all those communities and has the better picture of it. But, you know, just going through the experience of reviewing the response plans that Bend, and then now more recently with Ashland, actually Ashland's really came in at exceeding the bar, you know, very high. They've been very motivated. With Bend, there was a back and forth, and I think I mentioned last time, they really took feedback and really strengthened their plan, because the first one that came in didn't address those key kind of who are you going to communicate with? How are you going to identify people? And they went back and did that work and came back with you know, a very good plan. And I'm subscribed to their alerts, so I see when they're notifying people about prescribed burns, for example. So I think the process can work. And I would love for Margaret, if there's time, who really knows each of the programs. I've worked a lot with Wallowa County, but Margaret has a great perspective across all of them.
Yes, and thank you. Commissioner, to answer your question, they are all unique. And each of the local public health has a different level of ability to participate. But one of the things that we've noticed in communities that may have, you know, not have the same amount of funding to put towards that work is that sometimes the county commissioners have stepped in to serve an active role in some of the time consuming components of it. So attending the task force meetings, which, you know, having an hour meeting every other week can be really time consuming for two local public health authority members. And so when they can have somebody go represent them at the meeting and then fill them in a debriefing, that has been one of the ways. So it's really just been a community effort, and communities have had to pivot in that sort of manner in order to be able to accomplish it. But some communities obviously are able to attend, but really involvement has been good, and we've just been able to pivot in these unforeseen circumstances with COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. As a follow-up question to that, it's I'm glad to hear that it is working, and every group has a different amount of resources, right? So it's trying to make sure that those communities that want to participate and have these kind of exemptions have the ability to do so, even though they might have the smallest staff to be able to do it. Have you, in rolling this out, identified any additional needs to improve that type of community response planning?
Commissioner Kyle, I think there's now implementing those plans, and there's some resources needed for those who are developing plans to be able to implement them. But then just having more communities, you know, as Director Whitman said at the beginning, and you know, most of us all know, we're just going to be seeing more of this. So even outside of the smoke sensitive receptor areas, this is going to be an important, you know, area, body of work. And as Michael Orman was saying, it's great that there's conversations in the legislature recognizing that. I'll note also there is a bill that includes many recommendations from the Governor's Wildfire Council, which has OHA providing, creating a fund that OHA would administer to provide smoke filtration devices to the recommendation in the Governor's Wildfire Council was smoke filtration for low income and renter populations. And so we'll see, and there's a little bit more expansive body of work in one of the bills that the legislature is considering. So that's a very timely conversation. So having those resources, as Margaret was, you know, saying in the very timely deployment by City of Ashland to its residents, you know, really helped 400 households there to be more smoke resilient. So this is an ongoing conversation, and we all are going to need to do more. And certainly in the context of this prescribed burning conversation, or how do we reduce the fuel loads and protect health? We're going to keep working together on it.
Also, to supplement that, one thing that DEQ has done since we've launched these five community response plans is we have asked both the City of Ashland and the City of Oak Ridge to create a toolkit guide that they're both really doing exceptional in their different components. So obviously Ashland's done exceptional in smoke mitigation, and the community of Oak Ridge has done a really good job in their community response planning. And so we've asked them to create a toolkit guide that we can then give out to other communities to show them exactly step by step, this is how you can do it yourself. I don't think that will, you know, necessarily take the place for additional resources and funding that they may need, but it is at least something that we can do that will be helpful for those communities.
Okay, and I see Anderson, you. Yes.
Yes, go ahead. I was just going to say, I know this is such an important discussion, but Chair, I do think we're going to have an equally engaged conversation coming up. So perhaps there's a way that people could continue to share their comments on this agenda item. And in terms of time, we may need to be moving forward.
Yeah.
See fit, Chair.
No, I agree. I see that Joe has his hand up, but I guess my question is, Joe, is this a quick question and answer? Because we are quite over at this point.
Chair, it was just a quick comment. I just want to take a second just to thank Nick Yonkers as a Lander representative. I've worked with Nick over 20 years ago, burning in the Coast Range outside of Eugene for Rosewood Forest Products. And he has worked with landowners, you know, to get our objectives done for many years. And thank you very much, Nick, for that work. And I wish you all the luck in the world.
Great.
With your retirement. And the pivoting that the department and the DEQ have done related to COVID, thank you very much. And talking with State Forester Doherty and what we did. And that's a perfect example of how we've adapted to a current situation to protect Oregonians. So thank you. That's all I got.
Thank you, Board Member Justice. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Joe. And Commissioner, we'll turn this next item over to you.